Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It is February 7th, and we're going to have maybe a little bit of a review today, maybe go on to bones, but certainly a review, answer a bunch of questions, because what is happening next time? A test, that's right, your first test. And let's see, let's agree on what chapters are going to be on that test. Chapter 1, Chapter 2, Chapter 4, and 5. So four chapters. So that's like introduction, you got to know body planes, orientation, how you move with medial, lateral. 2 is cells, got to know everything about cells, like organelles, make sure you can, if I show you a picture of a mitochondria, you know what it looks like. Or if I show you a picture of rough ER, that you can label it. And also be able to tell me the functions of those various organelles. Like rough ER would be protein synthesis. Smooth ER would be lipid synthesis. Mitochondria is making ATP, energy source. So just have some bullet points on the tip of your tongue for those organelles, what they do. Know something about mitosis, of course, how to recognize it, how to characterize each of the different phases, and something about cytokinesis when that takes place. And then we went into tissues. There's a bunch of tissues you got to know. So there's, what are the four kinds of tissues? Connective, epithelium, muscle, and nervous tissue. And you have really good slides in your book, and then your study guide is really helpful. So there's a lot of good figures in study guides, and some of those figures I'm going to take from the study guide, put on the test, and have you label from a word bank. All right, so it's not like a practicum where you have to come up with a word. There's going to be a word bank. But you still should know the spelling, because maybe some of the words I put on there are sort of, I don't know if they're misspelled. If they're misspelled, they might be misspelled because I misspell them on accident.
Oh,
but there might be another word that's close but doesn't relate at all. Okay? So make sure you know, just don't memorize things. Simply try to really understand what the word means. Maybe understand the root or something a little bit and spelling. And then integument, which we covered last time, okay, and then you're really good. So in terms of the integument, I just want to make sure that you know where all your study materials are for that. So on the my off-campus webpage right here, there is an integument tutorial that you can listen to that goes over a figure that's very similar to the figure that's in your textbook. It is missing a couple things because it's for a Bio 160 class, so it's not quite at the same level you guys are at, but it's good for a review. And then in Blackboard, let's go to an anatomy class. I think this is one of you guys right here. In Blackboard under course documents, you do have three videos that I made for you guys on epidermis, dermis, and then accessory structures, which you can listen to, and these are off the models that you have in lab. So there's one lab that hasn't worked with these models yet, but today you will be working with them after the practicum with Dr. Sanchez. Remember, I won't be there for your practicum and afterwards. So you do the practicum and then press on after that to learn some skull bones and integument after your practicum today. Okay, but at least all of these things are available. And I forgot to mention to you all that here was that histology flash quiz. I forgot. Did anybody find this?
No.
This is, you know, would help you study for the practicum, but the practicum is basically over for everybody already. So there's a lot of good things in Blackboard. I forget exactly everything that's in there. Okay. Okay, so does anybody have any questions over those first four chapters? I see one question. Three sections, but the afternoon today is not online yet. Are you in today afternoon or when? Yeah, they're not online yet, but I'll get them in there probably tonight. Okay, and then I'll put your scores for the practicums up maybe before the weekend, and then you'll see it next time in class. So the Wednesday class, you'll get them back on Wednesday. Okay. All right. So questions? Yeah. Okay, yeah, I think that's pretty good. That's some information you should take with you to physiology, so I would guess it's an important kind of concept. So let me go back. That would be in Chapter 2, okay? Okay, so let me go back to chapter 2, and I don't think I'm going to pull up the word slide for this, but I'll go back to chapter 2. Let's see if I can get rid of that hum a little bit. Chapter 2. And because you should think of the cell membrane, so the question was, talk about the cell membrane a little bit and different ways that we can think about it. And here is a really good example of a cell membrane or plasma membrane right here. And it's important because it is an organelle. It's organizing a lot of functions that the cell is undergoing. And the other thing it does, it separates the non-living world from the living world inside the cell. And it acts as a passageway for things that the cell wants to ingest, and it keeps everything else out. And then it will also help with secretion when the cell needs to secrete something, or even get rid of waste products. So the cell membrane is very important. So there's two ways to think of the cell membrane. One, the very simple way, is that it is a phospholipid bilayer. All right, so that's a very introductory, cursory understanding of a cell membrane. So let me zoom into one region right here. And when we say phospholipid bilayer, I see something that has a sphere on it with a couple legs sticking down. This is a phospholipid. The spherical part right here is the phosphate part. And these little legs down over here are some fatty acids. This is the lipid part. And so the phosphate part likes to dissolve in water. And the lipid part, what do you know about lipids? Do they like to dissolve in water? Like if you get butter on your clothing before work or something, you can't just use a wet paper towel to get that butter off, right? So lipid molecules don't like to mix with water. That's why they're poking to the inside of the membrane. So the inside of the membrane is what we call hydrophobic region. This lipid molecule likes to associate with this other lipid molecule over here on the other side of the membrane. It makes for a very stable environment. Okay, and things that dissolve in the inner part of the membrane, like cholesterol molecule right here, is another lipid. So lipids like to dissolve in this part of the membrane. The outer parts, whether it's facing the extracellular space or the intracellular space, these are where the phosphate groups are, and these like to be around water. So they're poking to the outside, because the inside of the cell is watery and the extracellular fluid is watery. All right, so we see two layers of phospholipids. So that's a phospholipid bilayer. And because of this lipid internal region, it also means that things that are dissolved in water don't like to go through the cell membrane. They're stuck on one side or the other because they can't get through this lipid layer right here. So that's what separates the outside world from the inside world. Okay. So we said that things do move across the membrane. So special things have to be added to the membrane. So now we have to add to our impression of the cell membrane of being just a phospholipid bilayer right here, but more of the fluid mosaic model. So what is the fluid part that we're talking about? The phospholipid bilayer is just like a oily layer that you see on the surface of water. Okay, maybe you could put a drop of oil in your kitchen sink after you fill your sink up with water, and it just floats on top of the water. And if you jiggle the water inside your sink, what can you tell me about that oil that's floating on top of it? Does it break and fracture and sink, or what does it do? No, it wiggles right along with the water that's wiggling around inside the sink, right? So that's the fluid part of the membrane. It's very fluid because of the lipid nature of it. Okay, but that wouldn't really work for us, because if it was that fluid, as soon as we stood up, what would happen to all of our cell membranes? They would just run out on the floor. So there are some things that add rigidity to the cell membrane. That's the mosaic part of the cell membrane. So you got the fluid part, which is the phospholipid bilayer, but then we add proteins, which can be integral proteins that are inside the membrane, or external proteins that are outside the membrane that attach to the integral proteins. There can be cholesterol that also helps stabilize the membrane, that give it some rigidity. So those are things then that are added to the membrane to give them structure. But these other proteins can also perform other functions besides rigidity. Here is a passageway, right, that is a tunnel from the outside world to the inside world. And so this is what we call a channel. And in anatomy, sometimes we call that a foramen, but when we talk about membrane physiology, we call that a channel. This channel will allow movement of materials that can't get through the lipid part of the membrane, like salts, different kinds of ions. And the cell has the ability to open and close this channel, so at the appropriate time it opens up and ions can move through, and at other times the cell causes this channel to close, and then that keeps the outside world on the outside and the inside world on the inside. All right, some of these other proteins that we see in the membrane can act as antigens because they have, let me slide over here a little bit, because here are some sugar molecules, these things that look like stop signs. These are sugar molecules that have a certain shape, and all the cells in our body have a chain of sugar molecules attached to a membrane protein that have a particular shape, which is a signature that this cell belongs to our body. And if this sugar chain right here has a different shape, then your immune system knows that it doesn't belong to you, it belongs to somebody else. And in general, when your immune system finds a cell with an inappropriate antigen on it, a different kind of shape than what is yours, guess what your immune system does? It rejects it. Yeah, it attacks it, tries to kill that cell because it might be a tumor cell, or it might be a virus or a bacteria or a fungus that doesn't belong inside your body. Okay? So these are what we call antigens. Other kinds of membrane proteins, like this one right here, might be a receptor molecule. It might actually bind other molecules that are floating around inside your body, like a hormone. They float around all over, and when they bump into this receptor, that's going to change some physiology inside the cell. And so these would be receptors. So the plasma membrane is not just a phospholipid bilayer. Indeed, it is very fluid, but there are many other things that are added to it to give it additional functions for immune response, for communication with hormone signals, acting as signaling channels. And I think that's pretty much most of your list that you have right here. So phospholipid bilayer is a simple way of thinking of a plasma membrane, but the fluid mosaic model really is a more sophisticated, more complicated understanding of the cell membrane because it does many more functions than just separate the outside world from the inside world. Okay, it allows for communication and transport and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. The job of the cholesterol right here, okay? It actually helps form a nice crystalline matrix of the lipid so that it becomes a little bit more solid, okay? So that the membrane is not quite so runny. And the other part is that cholesterol is a building block for a number of important hormones, like testosterone and estrogen and corticosteroids and other kinds of mineralocorticoids. So it's also kind of a reservoir for the precursors for your body to build important signaling compounds. All right, so partly it's a structural feature, but also it's kind of like a chemical reservoir of cholesterol. So you need to have some cholesterol in your body, but not too much. If it's too much, then it will plug up blood vessels, okay? And it will then harm the membranes that it's in if there's too much of it, okay? So you got to have just the right amount. Okay. And there's some discussion whether it makes the membrane more fluid or makes it more solid, but my understanding is that it makes it more solid. If you take a biochemistry class right here, maybe you'll talk about maybe it makes the membrane in certain areas more fluid, but actually it should make it a little bit more crystalline. Make sure you understand from your professor what they think it is. Okay? Okay. Depending on if you're taking a biochemistry class or something like that. So that's plasma membrane. Don't skip over it. It's a pretty important organelle because of all those special functions that it performs. Okay, anything else on the cell before we move on? What's the basic building block of life? That's a cell. So if you understand how the cell is put together, you have a pretty good understanding of life. Now, what was that really strange thing inside the cell that is actually another organism that's living with you? Oh, good, I mentioned it. I can't remember if I mentioned it sometimes. That's a mitochondria. Okay, so what are three things that an entity has to have before it is considered a cell? It's got to have genetic material inside of it. It's got to have cytoplasm, right? So it's got to have a living matrix where certain functions take place, like protein synthesis, other kinds of metabolism. The cell has to make ATP, all right? And It has to have the plasma membrane, right, with all those special functions that we just mentioned. So it's got to have those three things: plasma membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. So this is a cell because I see a nice plasma membrane, I see genetic material, and I see cytoplasm. And remember, cytoplasm has two components to it. What are the two components for cytoplasm? Organelles, which we see right here, as well as the fluid part. What do we call the fluid part? Cytosol. All right, so this indeed is a living cell. But if we look at this organelle right here, which is a mitochondria, and consider it with those three basic criteria, guess what we have on the outside of the mitochondria? A membrane, which looks very similar to a plasma membrane. And I don't see it on this diagram, but mitochondria has its own chromosome. It's not inside of a nucleus, it's just floating inside the mitochondria. So it has genetic material, and there are living processes that are taking place inside a mitochondria, so it has cytoplasm. So it has a membrane, genetic material, and cytoplasm. It really satisfies all the conditions for being a cell. So here we have a cell inside of a cell. And this is now what we consider the endosymbiont theory. This was a bacterium at one time that invaded cells that had a nucleus, and they joined a partnership, which we call a symbiosis. Right, and they both got something out of the deal, and they learned to live together, and now they have evolved together to where this human cell can't live without mitochondria, and mitochondria can't live without this human precursor cell. Right, so that's the endosymbiont theory. And when we say theory, when somebody says theory, then that is what, a generally accepted idea that's backed up with a lot of experimentation, as opposed to a hypothesis, which is just a guess about something. Okay, so human beings are really a symbiotic organism with these mitochondria living inside of it. And if you were to look at a mitochondria, it would look very much like a bacterium. It has the same size, same shape, the chromosome is pretty similar. So sometimes you do have an infection with a bacterium, and sometimes we go to a doctor to help fight that infection. Guess what do we get? What might a doctor prescribe? Okay, an antibiotic, if it is an infection caused by a bacterium. Should you ever take an antibiotic for, say, like a virus, like a flu virus? No, you shouldn't, because bacteria will gain resistance, but the other couple other things, that antibiotic won't help you get over your flu at all. So you're taking medication for no good reason. And guess what happens whenever you take medication? There are side effects to medication, right? There's always going to be side effects. Somehow they're going to have some deleterious or harmful effect on your body that you have to get over. They're either hard on your liver, hard on your kidneys, or whatever. But when you take an antibiotic, guess what you have living inside all of your cells? These mitochondria. And what are mitochondria? Where did they come from? They're really bacteria. And you start to take a lot of antibiotics every once in a while. This is very rare. But every once in a while, somebody's mitochondria inside them that actually is now part of their body react to those antibiotics, and they're never the same afterwards, because those antibiotics now start to kill mitochondria that are inside their cells. And so that's another reason why I never take drugs unless it's prescribed by a physician. And don't ever ask for an antibiotic when you have a flu infection or a viral infection, because you could end up with some really bad side effects. Okay? Oh, sure, and antibiotics then kill the natural microbiota, the normal microbiota living in your digestive tract that you need to process foods, right? And for instance, like vitamin D and things of that nature, and other kinds of factors that your body needs. Okay, so that just kind of emphasizes this interesting endosymbiont theory of these mitochondria right here. Okay, all right, so that's pretty much it for the cell. Protein synthesis, where does that take place? On ribosomes. There are free ribosomes, and where else do you have them? On the rough ER right here. And for protein synthesis, how many steps are there to protein synthesis? I think we went over that. There are two steps. One step happens inside the nucleus. What step is that? What's that one called? It's converting information from DNA to RNA. That's transcription. Remember, RNA is very similar to a DNA molecule. So we call that transcription because it's basically making a photocopy of the information in the nucleus, and then that information leaves the nucleus, right? And that's where the second step takes place, in the cytoplasm, which we call translation, because it's taking information that is in RNA and then converting it into protein, which the language is what? Amino acid. So it's going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language in the cytoplasm right here. Okay. Why don't you want the DNA to leave the nucleus and go out into the cytoplasm to tell ribosomes how to make a protein? Why don't you want that DNA leaving the nucleus? Why is it in the nucleus? Yeah, because it's protected, right? It's protected. That is the information that's keeping the cell alive. If it goes into the cytoplasm, it could be damaged, and then the cell is going to die as a result. So the nuclear envelope protects that DNA from corruption, from being degraded. But it's converted into RNA, which then leaves, goes into the cytoplasm, and if that DNA is lost or damaged, no big deal, because there's still a copy of the original information inside the nucleus. Okay. So that's pretty good. What about that integument? How are you doing on integument? That's kind of what I was thinking of talking about today. Chapter 5. Okay, so make sure you can label all of these structures. Okay, so remember the three main layers of the integument. You got epidermis, which is an epithelium. And then you've got the dermis, which is connective tissue. And then below the integument, you've got a third layer, which is not really part of the skin. That is the subcutaneous layer, or you could say the hypodermis. Right? Sometimes we call that superficial fascia because it is adipose or loose areolar connective tissue. And we store a tremendous amount of lipid in this layer right here, which is an important energy source for us. Okay, now the epidermis right here doesn't have something. What does this epidermis lack that you see in the dermis? Blood vessels. Yeah, you see a lot of blood vessels right here. Okay, can you name the number of layers in the epidermis right here? Let's just say that it is thin skin. What are the layers? So we've got the living layer. That's the, and I'm just going to abbreviate S for stratum. That's basale. Okay, and then these cells right here kind of look spiky. They start to dehydrate maybe just a little bit. Desmosomes make connections between the cells that deform the cell membranes a little bit. So this is the stratum, period spinosum. All right, and this is also going to be your quiz in lab after you take the practicum. And then here's a layer right here filled with granules, that's the stratum granulosum. And then, we're running out of marker. Then what do we got here? Stratum corneum, right? Just squamous cells. And tell me something about these cells. Are they really cells? Yeah, they're dead. They're dead. They're filled with a compound that we call keratin. It's intracellular, it's not like collagen. But if you're looking at this JPEG right here, where are we going to find collagen? Are we going to find collagen anywhere? What layer are we going to find collagen? It's not in the epidermis, it's in the dermis because it's a connective tissue. So collagen is in connective tissue. All right, so keratin is there. But now in thick skin, we got an additional layer. Where is it going to be? Between the granulosum and the corneum, and it's going to just look nice and clear. That's why they call it lucidum. All right, so that's the stratum lucidum in thick skin. Stratum lucidum. Okay, so what about some layers of the dermis? How many layers you got to know? Four or five? Like in the epidermis? No, there's only two. So looking at the slide, we've got the papillary layer right here. It's named after these papillae, these ridges that poke up into the epidermis. There's a subpapillary plexus in there. There are blood vessels that nourish the epidermis, and I can see them over here. All right, so that's the papillary layer. That is a loose areolar connective tissue. It's not very strong, but this reticular layer right here, which is kind of a misnomer because it doesn't contain a lot of reticular fibers, it has a lot of collagen fibers, right? That's the part of your integument that's very thick and strong because it's loaded with collagen fibers. These, in thick skin, these dermal papillae can coalesce sometimes and form a ridge on the surface of the skin. What do we call that? When all these dermal papillae kind of line up in a certain area of thick skin. Now, where do you have thick skin? Hands? Palms of hands, soles of feet, you know, and the digits as well. So these, you might think are fingers, but those are really digits, and your toes are digits in anatomy, okay? You have fingerprints, okay? So if you're looking at part of the integument that doesn't have hair follicles, guess what kind of skin that is? That's right. Show me all the palms of your hands. I shouldn't see anybody with hairy palms, okay? Because it's thick skin, right? Thin skin has hair follicles right here. And in thick skin, the stratum corneum, of course, is a lot thicker, and you have ridges going through it as a result of all these dermal papillae. Okay, what about some accessory structures? Here's an arrector pili muscle. You should know if that, what kind of muscle that is. What are three kinds of muscle? You got smooth, skeletal, and cardiac. So cardiac muscles in your heart. No heart there, so that can't be cardiac. I don't even see a bone anywhere. So that can't be skeletal muscle. So by process of elimination, it's smooth muscle. And another way to figure that out is you have voluntary control whether or not you have goosebumps. You know, they just come and go depending on whether you're cold or other emotional content, right? But they're contracted by these nerves, which are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So arrector pili is a smooth muscle, which makes this hair stand up on end because it pulls the hair follicle over, pulls it up to the surface, so it forms a little wheel right here, or a welt. Then you've got three kinds of glands. You only see two on this diagram. Which two do you see? I see a sebaceous gland right here that secretes sebum onto the hair shaft so the hair shaft can grow out from the skin. And then also we have an eccrine sweat gland right here that secretes water and salt to the surface of the skin. And you have that on both thin and thick skin. What kind of gland don't you see right here but you see in lab? So some people might know this, but the lab that's this afternoon, they haven't seen this yet. That is an apocrine gland. So it kind of looks like an eccrine, but it's maybe 4 or 5 times the size. And that you don't have that all over your body. You have apocrine only in the axilla, inguinal region, and ear. Okay. And then you have some structures, some sensory structures, like a Pacinian corpuscle right here. You have others in thin skin that are located in the dermal papillae called Meissner's corpuscles, but they're not shown on this illustration right here. But Meissner's corpuscles you see on the models in lab and the pictures that I have for you in Blackboard. They kind of look like a Pacinian corpuscle, but they're a lot smaller. Pacinian corpuscle is for deep pressure and vibration. The Meissner's corpuscles that are much closer to the surface are for very light touch. Right, and so people use those for reading even. They can actually feel braille or dimples on the surface of a piece of paper. Okay, so that's the integument. You've got to know the two pictures of the illustration of what do we have right here. Here's a dermal papillae. What is this mostly an illustration of? This is mostly the epidermis, right? Epidermis. And of course you can tell this is a stratified, we could look at all the cell layers right here, squamous epithelium, named after these cells at the top. What do we call this top layer right here? That's the apical layer, and then down over here is the basal layer, right? So you can tell that this membrane is polar. These cells look a lot different than the ones down over here. Stratum basale is the living layer, and the JPEG that you have, I think you even see some of these cells undergoing mitosis, so this is the layer that is proliferating, that's growing by mitosis. You also have some melanocytes that produce melanin, right, which is a pigment. It absorbs light. It helps protect the skin from damaging sun rays. And then here is, this is a Merkel's disc. You could call it a tactile epithelial cell, Merkel's disc, for very light touch, kind of like a Meissner's corpuscle that we'd find in the dermis. And then we have an immune cell right here, which has two different names. Sometimes it's called a dendritic cell, but sometimes it's also called a Langerhans cell. Okay, so I think you should be able to label all of those, plus know the layers. So is this thick skin or thin skin? We've got basale, spinosum, granulosum, corneum. So that's thin skin, because otherwise you would have stratum lucidum right in this region right here, if it were thick skin. Okay. Okay, so that is really good for you to know. This is thick skin because I can see the stratum lucidum right through here. And I also don't see any hair follicles in that region. Okay. Let me put that away. Let's see if there is anything else. Oh, I know what we have to cover yet. Okay. All right, some other accessory structures. And let's talk about nails. Okay, we didn't talk about this last time. All right, so here we have a digit. This is the distal end of a digit. It's protected by this hard plate right here, which we call a nail. And this nail grows from this region right over here. And it's called the nail matrix. All right, so this is the proliferating area right here. It's like the stratum basale. These are keratinocytes that are multiplying and growing. And what does a keratinocyte produce? Keratin, which is a hard chemical, and that chemical, don't forget, is intracellular, but instead of growing in just kind of random segments that we have up on the skin, it forms a very flat plate that grows out from underneath the proximal nail fold right here. So a nail is really epidermal cells that forms very tough sheets, right, that grow out from the nail matrix. Right, and anything underneath the proximal nail fold right here is what we call the root of the nail. But you should know, where does the nail grow from? It grows from the matrix right here, not the root. The root is already dead. It's just being pushed out. All right, so here is the body of the nail, and here's the free edge of the nail right here. So these are just epidermal cells. Now, do you think these epidermal cells have more or less keratin compared to the cells that make up your skin?
More.
So it's harder. Right? And as a matter of fact, it's even harder than hair. Hair has a lot of keratin in it. It's made from epidermal cells, but again, it has more keratin than a normal skin cell does, but not as much as a nail right here. All right, so what else do we want to see? This area right here is highly vascular, right? And it produces this little discoloration looking through the nail, kind of looks like a little moon that's rising or setting on the horizon. We call that the lanuli. And here we have a cuticle. That is just the distal end of the nail fold. And that's pretty much it for nails. Okay, we can see some adipose tissue. Here's a bone. That's what's important for you to know. So I think this is an exam figure right here. Make sure that you could label that. Anybody have a question on nails? Yeah. You know, I don't have a sign-in sheet because I was stuck in lab and I couldn't get out of lab. So I could pass something around, but I think we'll miss the sign-in sheet for today. But I'm glad you asked. Okay, thanks for asking. Okay, and I think we talked about burns last time and the importance of a hair follicle. What's the importance of a hair follicle when it comes to burns or any kind of damage to the skin? The hair follicle acts as a reservoir for live stratum basale cells, right? So we're in places of skin right here where we don't have a hair follicle. Here's stratum basale, right? But as you bump into a hair follicle, look, that stratum basale goes way deep down into the dermis just because of the nature of the hair follicle right here. So when a superficial part of the skin is damaged, you still have a reservoir of stratum basale cells that line a hair follicle. So that's really important for regeneration of the epidermis after the skin is damaged. Okay, so that's pretty good for integument. So are you sure you guys don't have any other questions over any of those first four chapters? No questions so far? Yeah. The hair follicle, I don't think I have an exam figure there for you. Okay, so not exactly, but you should at least know that a hair follicle, here's the stratum basale, the hair follicle is made up of epidermal cells, right? And you could consider this like a little subpapillary plexus. There's a blood vessel inside the hair follicle, and here's the stratum basale, and there could be melanocytes in there. More melanocytes you have, the more active they are, then the darker the hair color you have, right? And the less active these melanocytes are, the lighter the hair color you have. Some melanocytes like to incorporate an iron molecule, in which case your hair will take a little bit more of a red color to it, right? And so these cells just grow out from the hair bulb right here. And they grow, these cells now grow in what, like columns instead of sheets. And so hair has a little bit different kind of structure to it. The only other thing is that there is a gland that's usually associated with a hair follicle. And what gland is that? I see it on this slide. Not over here, but over here. It is a sebaceous gland. Exactly right. So that's pretty much what you have to know about hair. Okay. All right. Well, I think I'm going to give you a little bit of an introduction to our next chapter, which is going to be chapter 6. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to put that away. I'm going to start with 7, just for one slide. Oh, aging. I thought maybe I talked about that last time. And maybe not.
Vitamin D production, temperature regulation, that's your function of insulin resistance.
Okay, aging. I do have some interesting comments about that. Okay, so we talked about these functions before, but it doesn't hurt to look at them once again. All right, the integument, one of the main functions is protection. Protection against what? Water loss, excessive water loss. Right? Plus, also, it acts as a barrier to keep microorganisms out of your body, so it helps prevent infection. Protection from ultraviolet light and sunlight because of, what are the cells that are responsible for that? Melanocytes that produce melanin, so you got to know names of cells and chemicals that they produce. Like, what kind of cell produces collagen? Collagen is produced by what kind of cell? Collagen you find in connective tissue in the matrix. Okay, that is a fibroblast, yeah, fibroblast. So it's good to know not just layers, but names of cells and various chemicals that they produce. All right, hair is a heat insulator, and it also allows you to communicate with your environment. You can feel things brushing up against you, and eyebrows feel things brushing up against them, and what is that going to produce? A blink reflex, right, to close your eyelids so that foreign bodies don't enter your eyes. And the same thing for nose and ears. There are hairs inside nose and ears to keep foreign bodies out. And nails are important for, it protects your tips of your digits and also for self-defense. Okay. Hopefully you don't have to use that one very often. Okay. But make sure you do if you ever have to. Ah, what's a good thing about nails if you're going to use them for self-defense? Well, they take pieces of your attacker with them, right? And then your attacker can be identified with a very nice DNA analysis. So don't be bashful about taking samples. The other important thing about the skin is temperature regulation. When you're cold, the blood vessels in your skin will vasoconstrict. What does that mean? Vasoconstrict means they get small. So a lot of blood doesn't go into them, so you maintain your core body temperature. Body temperature stays more inside your body. But when you're above normal body temperature, those blood vessels vasodilate. They get big. They carry a lot of heat up to the surface of the skin, which then your skin can radiate it off if it's cold outside, or if it's warm and humid out, you still can perspire, and the evaporation of perspiration then cools your body down. Okay. Okay, so when your core temperature is above 98.6, are your dermal blood vessels constricted or dilated? You're dilated, right? Because you're trying to take heat from inside your body and getting rid of it. Okay. Vitamin D is also important. It's a precursor to vitamin D is produced in the skin. So there's a fatty kind of precursor. And when it's exposed to ultraviolet light, it becomes an inactive form of vitamin D. And then that gets transported to the liver. And then that's converted into an active form of vitamin D. And you need vitamin D for calcium and phosphate. And that little I right there stands for inorganic phosphate. That's the kind of phosphate that your body can use. Both calcium and phosphate make bones strong, but calcium and phosphate also have other uses inside your body. So this inorganic phosphate right here, let's think, can anybody relate to inorganic phosphate? Where might you find an important use for inorganic phosphate in your body? What was an important energy molecule that we talked about? ATP stands for adenosine triphosphate. So ADP has three of these inorganic phosphate groups associated with it. So every time your body needs energy, it has to deal with phosphate metabolism. And that is helped regulated by what? Vitamin D. All right, so you see again, sunlight has some harmful effects because it can burn your skin, can damage DNA, but it also has some beneficial effects because it helps make vitamin D. And if you don't get any sunlight, then you need to take a dietary source of vitamin D. You need to take a pill. All right, so a little bit of sunlight is important for you. And then, of course, another function is sensation. Helps you communicate with the outside world. You know, if it's cold outside or hot or cold or whatever. Right? And you can also feel pressure and vibration. So it's just a way of communicating with your environment. So those are the important functions of the skin. Okay, aging of the skin. Most, you know, our skin changes as we grow older. And most of the age-related effects on the skin are a result of decreased blood supply or vascularity. That's what makes changes in our skin. So in order for cells to stay alive, they need oxygen and nutrients. And as the blood supply starts to dwindle in our skin, all of those cells start to lose some of their function. So as you get older, do you think your skin gets thicker or thinner? It gets thinner because it just doesn't have the same oxygen and nutrient supply. And so if the dermis gets thinner, what does that mean? It is more easily damaged. So if you have grandparents, you notice that it's much easier to damage their skin if they bump into something because it's just not as thick, not quite as much collagen as before. And then once your skin is damaged, it also means something else. It takes longer to heal as a result of that, just because it doesn't have the same kind of blood vessels. All right, so thin becomes thinner and more transparent as we age. And that's due to the retreat of blood vessels. Blood vessels just are not maintained in the skin as we get older. All right, so decreased collagen in the dermis means it's more easily damaged and repairs more slowly. Oh, we just said that. Okay. And fibroblasts don't, because they're dwindling, their metabolic activity is decreasing, then they stop secreting as many elastic fibers, right? And so then that magic saran shrink wrap that has been around your body now starts to sag a little bit as a result of those elastic fibers going away, right? And all the glands in your body, the apocrine and sebaceous glands and eccrine sweat glands, don't produce quite the same amount of product anymore because they don't have a blood supply. So let's relate what the sweat glands do, the eccrine sweat glands. They secrete water and salt, right? So as you get older, you can't perspire quite as much as you were before, which makes you more susceptible to hyperthermia, right? You can overheat a lot more quickly. So that's why when there's a heat wave, on the news, you always hear for elderly people especially to stay indoors and don't overexert yourself because you just can't compensate for the hot temperatures. And I really need to get a website for this, but about 5 years ago, it was in July, I believe, and Europe had a heat wave, which was highly atypical, especially in France. And during that time, almost everybody goes on vacation. And so even doctors in the hospital, everybody just leaves. So there's hardly anybody in hospitals. And everybody was down on the Mediterranean, and they left their grandparents at home, and this big heat wave hit. And over a weekend, almost 10,000 elderly people died of heat exposure because it never really gets that warm right there, so nobody had air conditioners, and nobody raced back home thinking of their poor grandparents at home. It was just, it was phenomenal, just in a weekend that thousands and thousands of people died as a result. So it's not something to be taken lightly. Okay, and that's due, so these glands stop working basically because blood flow to them is decreased. Okay, and activity in melanocytes. The metabolism of melanocytes goes a little crazy during that time as well. There might be an increase or decrease number of melanocytes in a certain part of your body, so you might get a little dark spot that produces age spots. Okay, and remember, what did we see at the base of a hair bulb? We saw a subpapillary plexus. Right, so hair has a tendency to turn gray or white as a result of decreased melanocyte activity within a hair follicle. Right, and something else too probably we notice, and that is, not only does our hair change color, but it easily falls out and doesn't get replaced because blood supply to that hair follicle is decreased as a result of that. So we have thin hair, not quite as thick. So that also, hair also protects us from what, sunlight? So again, elderly people are even more susceptible to sunlight as a result of that. Okay. Now here is something kind of strange. I think it's interesting. Some people might think it's a little bit strange, but no matter what your genetic makeup is, some people have really dark skin because their family history is from a more equatorial region on the planet, so you have darker skin. People from Northern Europe typically have very light-colored skin because the sun isn't so damaging up there. All right? But no matter where you're from and what color your skin is, as you get older, what happens to your hair? It turns gray, right? No matter what your ethnic background is, it just turns gray because of decreased vascularity, right? Why is it that your hair turns gray or white, but somebody with dark skin, as you grow older, your skin never turns white? Because it's the same kind of cells. They're just epidermal cells. I thought that was an interesting question when it popped into my mind and had to think about it. Why does that not happen? So I want to go back to actually this slide right here. Okay, and in particular, we're interested in what? Ah, this picture right here. Right, so here is that papillae with a vascular plexus in it, and so a blood vessel has to go up into here. These blood vessels, right, are more susceptible to age-related changes than blood vessels that are in your skin. Okay, so that's why hair just suffers more with age compared to the subpapillary plexus that's actually in the papillae within the dermis right here. Right, because these are where the melanocytes are that give your skin color, but the melanocytes that give your hair color are where? Way down over here. But if there is a way to maintain that blood supply to this hair follicle right here, then you wouldn't have any changes in hair over your lifespan. Okay? So that's kind of interesting. All right. Oh, there's something else, too, that happens as we get older. Well, I think, I mentioned it right here. Sebaceous glands. All right? Activity decreases. So that produces what? Less lubrication, less oily secretion onto the skin. So that makes your skin really dry. And it has a tendency to crack as well. Right, as we get older. So what do a lot of people do as they get older? They put a lot of lotion on, right? And I don't even know what the most expensive thing you could put on your skin, but it might be probably a couple $1,000 a bottle. It's amazing, right? And amazingly expensive. And it just kind of moisturizes your skin. But in order for you to have healthy skin, what do you need to maintain? Not just the oils, but if your skin is going to take care of itself, it needs what? It needs, where's the cursor at? Come on. It needs a blood supply, okay? And there's no kind of medication or any kind of treatment I know that is going to protect those blood vessels in the skin. So I probably wouldn't spend thousands and thousands of dollars on medication that just moisturizes your skin, right? Because you can find much cheaper things that do the same thing, okay? Exercise maybe will increase blood supply a little bit to some of these glands right here, Okay, exercise is always a good thing, but probably the most important thing to maintain the health of your skin is just to stay out of ultraviolet light as much as you can, or wear sun protection, okay, to keep those cells nice and, because ultraviolet light damages those blood vessels in the papillae. Okay, so those are things, and some interesting things about the skin right there. So no one has figured out a cure for aging skin, unfortunately, except maybe diet and exercise to some degree. Oh, I know what I wanted to do. Okay, a little bit of an orientation. I'm going to show you just a couple pictures in chapter 7 first. Not many. So if you don't have 7, that's okay. Okay, so skeletal system is just made up of bones. So we're going to start to know bones and spend a lot of time with bones, because it will help you through the rest of your class. Because in anatomy, we're going to learn the relationship of structures to some other kind of structure, and a good coordinate system for understanding how your body is put together is the skeletal system. It's so important, as a matter of fact, that once you know the skeletal system, you know a bunch of vascular anatomy, you know a lot of neuroanatomy, just by knowing the skeleton. So for instance, in the forearm right here, we have a couple bones. We have the radius bone, okay, and here's the thumb, right? Is this part of the skeleton in anatomic position, or is this one over here on the other side anatomic position? The first one or the, yeah, this first one over here, which is left, right? Because the thumb, which way is the thumb pointing? You can't say outside. It's lateral, right? The thumb is pointing lateral, and when it's pointing lateral, okay, so anatomic position is an important concept for the first test. The bones of the forearm run parallel to each other. If you're not in anatomic position, notice how the bones of the forearm actually cross over each other, which is much more complicated, which is why anatomic position is with the thumbs lateral. It's a simpler position to understand, okay, even though it's maybe not the most comfortable. So you got two bones. You've got the radius, which is what compared to the ulna? The radius is, how would you describe that position? The radius is, again, just like the thumb, it is lateral, so the radius matches up with your thumb, and the ulna is medial, is the medial bone in the forearm. Okay, so there are a couple of blood vessels that go through the forearm. There's one that goes over here, and guess what we call that one? It's an artery, okay, but the specific name, it's named after the bone, so that's the radial artery right there. So just by knowing bones, you know a lot of other stuff automatically. So in some sense, anatomy gets easier the more you stick with it. And then the ulnar artery is going to be what? Medial in the forearm. Okay, so that's some good news for you guys. And as a matter of fact, sometimes you want to find out if somebody has a pulse, or you want to count somebody's heart rate. Where is a good place to do that? Okay, and maybe some people would say, well, it's the radial artery. Now you know where that is. Where is that? That's just superior to your thumb right there. The radial artery goes very superficial, and you can palpate it, and it is far away from your heart. What's a way of saying something that's far away from your heart? It's distal. So some people say, oh yeah, just take somebody's distal pulse. Because why? It's far away from your heart, and that's the radial artery right there. You could palpate a more central artery, maybe like the carotid up over here in your neck. Another place to take a distal pulse, right, would be the pedal pulse down here in somebody's foot. Okay? So knowing bones is really, really helpful. So the skeleton can be broken up into two main classes of bones. And that's because we see two different colors right here. We see kind of a gray color bones right here. And then we see some yellow colored ones right over here. So bones that make up the skull, the vertebral column, the ribs, and the sternum right here are what we call the axial skeleton. So you should know, eventually you're going to know the names of each of these bones right here, and then you should just automatically know, oh, that's an axial skeleton bone, right? As opposed to the ones that make up your upper appendages and lower appendages, we call those the appendicular skeleton bones, right? So we got appendicular skeletons for your upper appendages, lower appendages, but also a couple bones that attach, for instance, the lower appendage to the axial skeleton, and it surrounds your body. Okay, you can put on a device that surrounds your body, or at least women do. What is that called? A girdle. Anytime you surround something, that's called girdling. Okay, girdling is completely surrounding. So this right here is called the pelvic girdle. These bones make up the pelvic girdle. So pelvic girdle helps attach your lower appendage to your axial skeleton. There are some bones that completely surround your superior chest right here. So that is a girdle, but it's not the pelvic girdle, that's the pectoral girdle, right? So that's the pectoral region right here. So here's the pectoral girdle, and that helps attach your upper appendage to the axial skeleton. Okay, so break the skeleton down into axial and appendicular skeletons. So when we start talking about all these bones, okay. The other thing that we're going to look at, I guess maybe are some functions of bones. Maybe I have to go back over here. Maybe I should open up skeletal tissues right here. Okay, components of the skeletal system. That's a pretty good place to start. Well, you got bones, okay, and you have ligaments. What the heck is a ligament? Okay, it's an attachment, right? A ligament is dense, regular connective tissue that attaches a bone to a bone. So there are various ligaments in your body. You have a lot of ligaments in your shoulder, a lot of ligaments in your ankle right here that attach bones to each other. And then you also have cartilage. Different kinds of cartilage. Guess how many different kinds of cartilage you have? Three. Very good. Because you are tested on that already. You have hyaline cartilage, which covers the ends of bones. It forms articulations. You have fibrocartilage that makes intervertebral discs that has collagen in it. It's a very strong kind of cartilage. Also the pubic symphysis right here, the joint between two of these pelvic bones, that is fibrocartilage. All right, so it's not continuous bone right here because sometimes that these pelvic bones have to separate apart. That joint has to dissolve away so that these pelvic bones can separate when it would be a natural time for that to happen. How about during parturition? Yeah, during birth. Okay, and then after parturition, then the bones come back together again, mostly. Okay, okay, so that's fibrocartilage, and then you got elastic cartilage, like we have in our ear. Okay, so those are the three kinds of cartilages. All right, so those are the components of the skeletal system. So what are some important functions? Well, because bones, okay, are really strong. They don't compress because of the material that makes them up, namely calcium and phosphate molecules. And bones also have that tubular histological appearance to them. They're tubes inside tubes. So bones can support great weight. That's really important. And muscles can attach to bones and can pull on bones and not break them. So bones are good for movement as well. And then cartilage, on the other hand, is a lot lighter than bone, but it helps form structures like your ear, passages in your nose, parts of your rib cage. All right, so that's a big advantage to cartilage because it weighs a lot less. But nonetheless, it is still firm and flexible. And then during development, before you have a bone in your body, in many cases, you actually have a bone that's formed out of cartilage. So that cartilage acts as a model for where bone should be in your body at a later time. So that's one way that bone is made, okay, from converting cartilage to bone in a process we call ossification. All right, then we also mentioned, well, in lab we mentioned, that's right, not in lecture yet, bone is important for protection, like your skull. There are certain bones of the skull that protect your brain. Those of you that have had lab already, what do we call those bones that protect your brain? Those are what, yeah, somebody said it, cranial bones. So we have cranial bones that protect your brain, and then we have another class of bones in the skull that make facial bones. So basically we have two kinds of bones that make the skull, cranial and facial bones. The rib cage, right, that we see right here protects certain organs. Like what organs would you want to have protected right here? Like your heart and lungs, very important, yeah. And great blood vessels as well. Blood vessels, you should think of organs, right? And the vertebral column. What does the vertebral column protect? Not only does it support your weight, but it protects your spinal cord. All right, so brain and spinal cord are important parts of your central nervous system. They're both protected by bones. All right, skeleton is also important for movement because muscles attach to bones. Like there's a muscle that goes from the bone in your arm down to the forearm, and that's going to cause either flexion or extension depending on where that muscle is located. And bones will move at some joint between bones. And then some bones have ligaments between them to suppress motion, right, to maintain posture, to maintain the position of a movable joint so that it doesn't get damaged. And then two more things for bones. It's an important storage form for calcium, that you kind of knew already, but also it's an important for a storage place for phosphate, inorganic phosphate. And what do you need inorganic phosphate for? To make ATP. That's one thing. We'll learn maybe many other things for phosphate. And on the inside of bones, there's a cavity. And that cavity, when we're really young, is important because it makes red blood cells. That cavity is filled with substance we call marrow. There are two different kinds of marrow. If it's making red blood cells, then we call it red bone marrow. But after a while, as we grow up, that red bone marrow is converted into yellow marrow, and yellow marrow is just adipose tissue. So it's another storage form of energy inside of our bones. Okay, and that takes us to the last function of bones, and that is in red bone marrow, we call that a hematopoietic tissue. Red bone marrow on the cavities inside bones make red blood cells and platelets. Right, so hematopoietic tissue is a tissue that makes what? Red blood cells. And I think I mentioned in here, how many red blood cells die in your body every second? About 2 million. Okay, about 2 million. So that means that this red bone marrow in these long bones right here, or even in some flat bones like the sternum right here, how many red blood cells do they have to make every second? Yeah, 2 million. Otherwise, you become anemic as a result of that. So there's hematopoietic tissue in the cavities of bones, just to make sure that we don't become anemic. And what's the function of a red blood cell? Why do we have them? Carries oxygen, so those mitochondria are nice and healthy so that they can make ATP for us. All right, so after the test, we're going to start to look at some cartilage. All right, so a week from today, we're going to start by looking at some cartilage. So maybe I'll highlight that right there so I know where to start. All right, any questions on the test at all? No electronic devices, no hat, hood, sunglasses, good pencil, and a good eraser. Probably a good eraser is more important than a pencil. Okay? In case you need to erase something. It's worse to make a smudge on a Scantron. Yeah, don't smudge a Scantron up.